Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Utah Lieutenant Governor Henderson compares President Trump's voting list order to nonsensical dialogue. As early as third grade, Utah students will need to study Bible passages in social studies lessons under a new law. Authorities say Ted Bundy killed a Utah teen found dead more than 50 years ago at American Fork Canyon. And the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints unveils major changes to its Sunday worship services. Joining me on the program today, later in the program, Salt Lake Tribune investigative reporter Jessica Strifles will be with us, and senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. We hope to be joined soon by State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern. We bring in education reporter Carmen Nesbitt. Carmen, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Always a pleasure.
Good to have you on. Let's jump in. So I guess the first story here, a law passed which would require Utah students as early as third grade to study Bible passages. What would this do specifically?
Yeah, I mean, the title pretty much explains what's going to happen here. So the law is HB 312, and it is sponsored by Tierra Oxier, who's a Republican out of Morgan. And basically what it does is it tasks the Utah State Board of Education to develop new social studies curriculum that includes references, includes Bible passages that are referenced in our founding documents, or concepts in the Bible that are referenced in our founding documents. The law specifically mentions the terms nature's God, creator, supreme judge of the world, and divine providence, which appears in the Declaration of Independence. And those concepts in particular would be explored through Bible passages, but in a historical and literary context. The law is pretty clear that, you know, we're not teaching religion, but we are, having kids study these texts as the law claims influenced our founding.
So proponents of this bill, which I think include Governor Cox, others, are saying it's logical to look at the foundations of what the founders of the country were influenced by.
That's correct. Yeah, that's the basis for this law. There's, you know, the argument out there that the Bible did directly influence our founding fathers, and a lot of its concepts do appear within our founding documents, specifically the Declaration of Independence.
So you talked to Patrick Elliott, legal director for Freedom From Religion Foundation. What are his concerns?
So his concerns are basically that this is unconstitutional. You know, we do have separation of church and state in our country. And, he did say that he believes it's unconstitutional, and that... the other thing is that he's not sure if there are other states that have passed a law like this. Now, there are other states that have passed legislation allowing students to partake in optional Bible-based courses. You can see that in Oklahoma, in Hamilton County School District in Tennessee. They have a program called Bible in the Schools, and that's sponsored through the organization so named that helps fund elective courses examining the Bible through an academic lens. There have been other, curriculum in Texas that, students study certain Bible passages in English courses, but nothing that has been passed through legislation like this. Usually it comes through like a state board mandate or elsewhere, like within an individual school district. But this is, we're kind of seeing, according to Patrick Elliott, the first of its kind, I suppose, like as a law, right?
So there's a law professor at University of Utah, Cliff Roskey. He said in your story that this bill does not violate the First Amendment, but I think he has some concerns.
Yeah, he said on paper, this law, it walks a very fine line. His words were that it was carefully drafted by somebody who understands, Supreme Court precedents in this area and, the Constitution and those guardrails that are set forth there. He said, so on paper, it doesn't violate the First Amendment. Now, he said, in practice, it could violate students' and teachers' constitutional rights. He also mentioned it was kind of unusual, right, to pass this sweeping social studies requirements for students as young as third grade. I mean, we're starting early.
What are some other concerns that people have with this?
So I spoke to another professor of history at he's at the U, Eric Hinderaker, and he said that what we're seeing, especially in GOP-led states, is this embrace of Christian nationalism, which is this idea that the US was founded as a Christian nation and should be governed with Christian values. And that there's this idea in our country right now that, those Christian values are under attack, and sort of Christian nationalism is the answer to this. And he sees this law as, Utah lawmakers propping up Christian nationalism. He also mentioned that there's just a fundamental misunderstanding about the place of religion in public life during the era, when our country was founded. And he mentioned that, our founders were coming out of a country where, state-supported religion was the norm, and government and religion were one and the same, and they just saw that as a huge, huge problem. And he kind of said, it's misleading, in fact, to suggest that the Bible is an especially important text that influenced American constitutional history. And he said that the founding fathers intentionally chose not to make any references to the Bible. And a law like HB 312 is something that they were trying to avoid altogether.
The bill sponsor, Representative Oxier, I'm not sure how you say her name.
That sounds about right. Yep.
Okay, she said that she wants Utah to be able to control its own civics curriculum, right? Her
That's
quote
right.
is, "We don't want to be have to get textbooks from California."
Yeah, essentially that's it. Utah wants its own Utah-centric civics curriculum rooted in Utah values. That's essentially what she said. We don't really want to outsource that any longer. And so that comes with a $12 million price tag to develop this new curriculum. And I'll definitely be following along as USBE, it takes steps to essentially pick out what Bible verses kids will be required to study. They have until the 2028-29 school year, so we have a little bit of time, but I think it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out.
Yeah, you mentioned the money, an expense, and there's a debate over how much this is going to cost, but an expense to create your own whole new curriculum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there an opt-out if parents don't want their kids doing this?
So Utah law, it allows parents to opt their children out and students themselves to opt out of any school activity that's against their own, religious beliefs. But because this curriculum will be required, right? This isn't an elective. This is going to be built into what students have to learn in social studies to earn the credits, required credits for graduation. I'm not exactly, it's not yet clear what the opt-out or alternative will be, so they could still earn those credits. I'm assuming that question will be answered in time, but right now it's to be determined.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines. We're talking with Salt Lake Tribune education reporter Carmen Nesbitt. Well, speaking of third graders, Carmen, let's talk about a bill that did pass. We talked about this several months ago. Now it's made its way through the legislature. I believe it has passed Senate Bill 241. Here's the headline of this story I'm looking at. Here's a breakdown of Utah's sweeping plan to hold back struggling third grade readers. So I guess that's the top line. Under this law, a third grader could be held back if they're not up to reading a standard.
That's right. So this law, yes, it did pass and it will go into effect by spring 2030. And so what this law does, I kind of compare it to a roadmap in the article. It's this sweeping new roadmap to improving our literacy scores. And right now, I believe about half of Utah's third graders aren't reading at grade level. And so this law is the sort of solution to that. And what it does is it kind of adds a very, a comprehensive, robust intervention starting, as early as kindergarten. And it lays out all these specific things that schools now will be required to do if they're seeing that a student is not reading on grade level. And the way they track this is through benchmark testing. We use a test here called a Cadence in the state. It's given to kids 3 times a year just to track how they're doing. And what the test shows is, for a kindergartner at this point in the year, does their reading skills, literacy skills, match up to what they should be at this point? And so there's going to be a lot more heavy reliance on a cadence and benchmark testing, so that the interventions can happen a lot sooner. Now, if by the time a child reaches third grade, and in the last benchmark test of the year, state law, and they don't perform on, on par, state law will require that student to be held back. So I think, or not I think, but the bill's interventions prior to that point is to avoid that, right, at all costs. And there's a lot of direction in this bill that parents must be involved. They must be notified. They'll get an email every time their student doesn't, scores below or well below on benchmark assessments. So the plan is, the hope is that everybody, the teachers, the parents, the students, everybody is going to be involved, and everybody will be, aware of where the student is. So that if retention does happen, it shouldn't come as a surprise.
Okay, yeah, thanks for updating us on that. We have maybe a minute left in this segment. I want to just give me the top line of this. You put out a survey to educators. What's on their minds? What are their challenges? So what are the top things they said?
At the time that we published this, about more than 40 teachers, administrators, and psychologists And other specialists that work in schools had written in. And so I went through all their responses. And the number one challenge in schools today was resources or lack thereof. Just not enough people, mostly, right? When we talk about resources, a lot of them we're talking about manpower in the schools to meet students, increasingly complex needs.
Yeah, check out the full story at sltrib.com to get that. Unruly, sometimes apathetic students was another one. They complained about the legislature, whiplash legislation. Yeah, check out that story. Interesting. Carmen Nesbitt, education reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course.
We turn next to Emily Anderson Stern, State Watch reporter for the Tribune. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
I want to get this one in and hopefully maybe a story on Utah seeking to be a nuclear hub. But this one stuck out to me. Utah Lieutenant Governor Henderson compares President Trump's voting list order to a nonsensical dialogue. So this is the Trump administration wanting states to hand over their voter rolls, right? What is Utah saying to that?
Well, she actually used the term in response to an executive order from President Trump that came out earlier this week, which essentially aims to create the federal government would create its own lists of eligible voters based on citizenship and age that it would then send to states that they would have to use in upcoming election. And then it would crack down on mail-in voting by also requiring that states take those lists and then out of those people on the list, determine which ones are registered to vote, give another list to the U.S. Postal Service, and is for states that allow people to vote through the mail, which would include Utah. And then the U.S. Postal Service would not be allowed to deliver ballots if people were not on the list. Lieutenant Governor Henderson, she said she compared the text of the order to a play she said that she performed when she was a senior in high school. An absurdist play by the playwright Eugene Ionesco called Jack or the Submission. And she said, and it so essentially, yeah. I'll read her post here, which said, "When the latest executive order reminds you of that time when you were a senior in high school and you performed in a one-act play called Jack or the Submission by absurdist playwright Eugene Ionesco, and it was super weird and the script was full of nonsensical dialogue." So taking a jab at this executive order, essentially saying it didn't make sense. And as you mentioned earlier, this does come as she's fighting a lawsuit from the Trump administration's Justice Department over which wants to gain access to Utah's voter databases.
Trump administration is trying to get many states' voter rolls, right? The states are fighting back. So not just Utah, but I think Utah makes the news because this is a Republican led state, and they're fighting back. The legislature, I think, weighed in a bit on some of these issues, didn't they? They made some new restrictions.
Elections has been a pretty hot topic for the legislature since 2020, the 2020 presidential election, when you saw now President Donald Trump, who's the head of their party, lose the election to former President Joe Biden. And then, even prior to that election taking place, he began raising doubts about the integrity of election systems in the US. And after that, you kind of saw a ripple effect across the country, especially in, Republican-led states, trying to change their election systems. And many times the changes that were made Would make it harder for people to vote. But one of the things that's been happening in Utah, as we see President Donald Trump raising doubts about the integrity and the security of voting by mail, you've seen some Republican lawmakers, not all, but some, try to get rid of Utah's really popular vote by mail system. In the past, the system is still currently universal, where everyone gets their ballot in the mail. Every active registered voter gets their ballot in the mail, and they can return it through the mail. After an attempt to essentially ban vote by mail last year, lawmakers who were against that worked and landed on a compromise where everyone in Utah will have to opt in to receive their ballot through the mail by 2029. And then there was another attempt this year to which would have could have essentially eliminated vote by mail. It ended up being changed a bit so that people would have had to not only opt in to receive their ballot in the mailbox, but also to opt in to send their ballot back through the mail when they registered to vote. So when they're registering to vote, they would say, "Yes, I want to receive my ballot in the mailbox." Then also check whether they would return their ballot through the mail or whether they would return it at a drop box. So they'd have to think way ahead of time how they would vote. And if people were returning it at a drop box, they would have had to show their ID to return it. And they would have had limited hours to return it because they would have had to done so when at least two poll workers were staffing the drop boxes. Really would have reduced the amount of time that people could have voted. And especially in rural areas where it might have been harder to staff some of those drop boxes. But those were some of the biggest attempts to change elections in Utah. There was one that was successful that was similar to this executive order, where Utahns will have to show documentary proof of citizenship, or add documentary proof of citizenship to their voter registration before they can vote in the November general midterm elections. I will say that this is a lot less strict than a proposal that's been in front of Congress recently, where most Utahns have satisfied the requirement by adding their driver's license number or voter ID or state ID number or the last four digits or social security number to their voter registration that's already on there. But it will impact a lot of people in the state who've been registered to vote for a long time, older voters, and not all of them are super internet savvy. It's not super easy for them to get onto the Lieutenant Governor's website and add those numbers to their registration. But those are the ones who do not, most likely do not have documentary proof of citizenship. And so it could be more difficult for them to vote this year. County clerks are supposed to let people know if they don't have that proof. But yes, that's an extra barrier to voting that some Utahns will see this year.
All right, thanks for telling us about this. We'll just mention the other story. We're out of time here. Utah wants to build a massive federal nuclear facility near the Great Salt Lake. Have you go to sltrib.com to check that one out. Emily Anderson Stern, Statewatch reporter, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
And coming up following a break on Behind the Headlines, we're going to be talking with Salt Lake Tribune investigative reporter Jessica Strifles. Here's the headline. Authorities say Ted Bundy killed a Utah teen found dead more than 50 years ago in American Fork Canyon. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll stay with us through the break.
Flowers are more than decorative. They promote pollination and also preserve the genetic lines of plants. But when did these attractive structures first arise?
The physical first flower is like a holy grail, and it's been a bit of a holy grail since Darwin.
Can we find evidence of the ancestor of all flowers? And could we also improve on chlorophyll? It's Flower Power on Big Picture Science.
Tune in Sunday morning at 11 here on UPR.
Programming support here on UPR comes from our members and Science Unwrapped in USU's College of Arts and Sciences, presenting Earthquakes, Predicting the Unpredictable, with geoscientists Lindsay Broderick and Sreesharan Sreetharan. April 10th at 7 p.m. in the Eccles Science Learning Center on USU's Logan campus. More at usu.edu/unwrapped.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in for this segment Salt Lake Tribune investigative reporter Jessica Strifles. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
So here is the headline we want to talk about. Ted Bundy killed a Utah teen found dead more than 50 years ago in American Fork Canyon, as according to authorities. So we do know that Ted Bundy was in Utah for a while. We do know he killed some young women, but we didn't know, I guess, connect him officially to this victim. Tell me about this.
Yes. Yeah, so in 1974, a young woman, a 17-year-old named Laura Ann Amy, she disappeared, and her body was found a month later. She just disappeared on Halloween. Her body was found a month later by hikers in American Fork Canyon. And, you know, for a long time, Ted Bundy has been suspected of being the person that killed her. And, you know, before he was executed in Florida, he confessed to a lot of different murders, you know, in the days before his execution, and this was one of them. And so people for quite some time had figured that Ted Bundy had done it, but the case was technically still open because the Utah County Sheriff's Office and the attorney's office didn't think that that verbal confession was quite enough evidence to definitively close the case at that time.
This was confirmed using new forensics techniques, to quote the announcement. What are these techniques?
Yes, exactly. So the Utah County Sheriff's Office announced yesterday that the case was officially closed, that they were able to match DNA from the crime scene in the Amy case to a DNA profile of Ted Bundy's in Florida. And how they were able to do this is, you know, DNA technology is always, you know, improving and getting better. And so there was kind of like mixed DNA and small amounts of DNA in this sample. And so using this new technology, this improved forensic technology, they were able to pull out this male DNA from, you know, kind of very old and maybe not the strongest DNA profile. The technology has just advanced so much now that they were able to pull a profile off of that. They put it into a national database that all the states contribute information into, and that came back with the hit that it was Ted Bundy.
So I imagine the family's appreciative to have closure here. What was the family saying?
Yeah, Amy's family, a lot of them were at the press conference yesterday, and it was really interesting. Her sister said that she didn't even know that the case was still open. I think that they, like everyone else, had kind of assumed that with Ted Bundy's confession that meant the case was closed. So she was really appreciative that the detectives, you know, were still interested in this case and wanted to bring that closure. She thought her sister would be happy to know that there's this closure now and this definitive evidence that says who her killer was. And so they were just really appreciative that law enforcement still cared about this case and that people generally, you know, still want to know about this and wanted to learn more about her sister and, you know definitively who her killer was.
It's quite poignant to just see photographs of the sister who's lived a life, right? And then Laura Ann was not able to live that life, died at 17. Tell me about Laura Ann Amy.
Yeah, she She grew up in Fairview, had been living in Utah County, but she definitely seemed to be, as was described by family members, you know, really loved horses, really loved being on the farm and working with animals. And, you know, that was just, she was a very kind person. She liked playing basketball. And so that was kind of doing all the things that kids who grew up on a farm do. That was kind of the things that she loved to do.
So Ted Bundy is believed to have killed at least 5 in Utah, possibly 8. Are there others that are not definitively tied to Bundy at this point?
They did mention at the press conference yesterday that there's a possibility that their DNA profile, now they have this like very full and complete DNA profile for Ted Bundy in Utah, that it could help solve other cases. And they did say that there was one other case in particular that might be close to coming to the same resolution. But when they were kind of pressed for details on that, they didn't want to comment since it was active. So I'm not actually 100% sure if that's even in Utah or if that's somewhere else. But definitely we could see, I think, similar announcements like this. You know, with the new technology, you know, using the same methodology, comparing DNA samples to what they were able to identify here in Utah, I think that could help close other similar cases that are still open.
What about law enforcement? There's a photo here, the sister, Michelle and Paula, embracing Brent Bullock, who was one of the original investigators, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. The original investigator was there. He didn't speak at the news conference, but you know, it was interesting to kind of see, you know, these like generations, right? This homicide happened more than 50 years ago. And so to hear the people who are, you know, leading the office now, just we're really appreciative of these detectives, you know, who first investigated this case, because they did a really great job, they said, of, you know, preserving this evidence to the point where there was still, you know, a really clean case file and evidence to look at 50 years later. So they really gave a lot of acknowledgement to the good policing that those officers did at that time when the homicide initially happened.
There's a very impactful scene. I guess this is a Utah investigator, Utah law enforcement official, when Ted Bundy, I guess, was confessing to all these crimes, went and interviewed him in Florida.
Yeah, so he was executed in Florida, and I don't have the year quite in front of me, but before he was executed, you know, Bundy met with investigators from, you know, all different law enforcement agencies, and he'd confessed to killing multiple women in Utah and I think in other states as well. And there was a Salt Lake County sheriff's detective who interviewed him prior to his execution. And, you know, we were looking through our archives and some of our archive reporting showed that when that detective asked Bundy about Amy's death, the detective told a reporter that the man could not look me in the eyes. He put his head in his hands and would not answer the question. So there's some accounts that he did directly confess to Amy's murder, but never really gave a lot of details. And then there's this quote as well. So there really hasn't been a true detailed confession, which I think is why this case has been still open for so long, because it just didn't feel like quite enough to the investigators to feel like they could actually close the case with like that type of confession.
So I guess authorities are hopeful, somewhat hopeful, with new techniques, they can maybe close some of these cases.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think that they see this as an opportunity for other agencies who might have open cases to either use, you know, the Ted Bundy DNA profile to help make matches in their own case, or maybe use the techniques.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say about this story?
No, I think we covered it.
Okay. I'd like to, time remaining here, talk about this one. Here's the headline: Utah bans polygraph tests for those reporting sexual assault. This is Angela Romero ran this bill. It was successful after, as you say, a couple of years where it was not successful. So what will this bill do?
So what this bill does is it does not allow government officials, so police, prosecutors, any other government worker, from asking a person who's reporting that they were sexually assaulted to take a polygraph test. And the reason for this is, you know, experts have studied this, and polygraph tests are kind of problematic anyways. They're not allowed in any courtroom. But for particularly with victims of sexual abuse, they are unreliable. You know, these polygraph tests don't actually measure whether you're being truthful. They measure your body's response. And so, you know, if you are really stressed or have a lot of anxiety answering a question, it could come back that you are potentially being deceptive. But many sex assault victims have those same stressors and feel anxiety, and, you know, they're re-traumatized recounting their assault. And so sometimes those stress responses come across as deception. And so a lot of other states have already banned this. And so Utah has just joined a growing list of states where this is now not allowed. The like police and prosecutors can't ask sex assault victims to do a polygraph test.
Representative Romero said she ran the bill for a couple of years, and she brought it back. Specifically, she said, on behalf of a victim of the therapist, Scott Owen, who's now been convicted, the person we're calling Andrew. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I spoke with Andrew a couple of years ago, and he told me about how he had been touched inappropriately by his therapist, Scott Owen, and he had gone to state licensors to report him. And, you know, this is essentially one person's word against the other. And Scott Owen initially denied that any touching had occurred. And so the licensing investigator had asked Andrew if he would take a polygraph test. And he agreed, you know, thinking this could just bolster his case. And what ended up happening was it showed that he was being, or it indicated deception. And for him, that was just so, you know, devastating and really affected his mental health and really harmed him. And he eventually withdrew that complaint. He didn't want to participate anymore because of how harmful this was to, you know, literally not be believed by licensors or by government officials. But then, you know, as we've talked about on this show before, Scott Owen continued practicing for more years. There were more complaints. You know, more people were harmed after Andrew had went and reported. And so I think this, for Angela Romero, this just showed an example of somebody who wasn't believed and that their perpetrator was able to continue harming people because, you know, action wasn't taken when they did try to come forward and report what was happening.
You note that Representative Romero's bill in each of the iterations was supported by prosecutors and police. Took this last session to make it pass, that it passed. Some defense attorneys were opposed to this restriction. Why?
Right. So, yeah. So it took three sessions for Representative Romero to get this bill passed. And it was really interesting because she had the support of prosecutors and law enforcement, but there were defense attorneys who said that, you know, that they felt this could be a tool when trying to figure out, you know, who, like, what the truth is in these scenarios. And so, you know, if they have a client who says, no, I nothing happened, or like, this was a consensual thing, that they feel like this could be a tool that could maybe guide prosecutors or investigators in their decision making on whether to bring charges. Because again, polygraph tests are not admissible in court, regardless if you're the defendant or the victim who takes one. So these aren't something that a judge or a jury will ever see, but sometimes they're used to maybe indicate to a prosecutor or an investigator that they need to consider, you know, maybe this isn't a good case or whatnot. And so they think that this is still a valuable tool that could be used in these type of scenarios where there's not a lot of witnesses or a lot of, you know, evidence. It's kind of one person's word against the others.
Now, there's a new state task force. Tell me about this.
Right. So, you know, a lot of my, or this reporting that we've done has focused on sexual assault in healthcare settings. And the state licensing department actually just created a new state task force that they said is going to look into the rise of sexual misconduct complaints that they've seen against their licensed professionals. So where they're focusing on is in the healthcare industry, mental health, which, you know, is a Scott Owen case that we talked about, and then in massage therapy. And they said that these are the division or the professions that they see the highest percentage of sexual misconduct complaints. So what they plan to do with this task force is to, you know, get people together and focus on changing the laws, maybe creating more resources for victims so they can more easily report these type of misconducts. And then maybe developing a standard process for sharing reports among agencies, because that's not required right now. Like if someone goes to licensors and says that, you know, my therapist touched me inappropriately, that doesn't mean that the licensors then go to police and say, hey, we think there's a crime here. Like that conversation between agencies just isn't happening always, and it's not required to happen at this point in Utah law.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned a couple of times, good to highlight it again, a lot of this happening based on reporting, right? You're reporting the Tribune, ProPublica?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, this was a story that we published a couple of years ago, as I said, in our series about sexual assault in healthcare settings. And so, yeah, this was a story that we reported that highlighted, you know, kind of the ways in which this person was allowed to continue practicing, even though there had been complaints filed to licensors and in other places, you know, from patients before he was finally arrested and now he's in prison.
We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune investigative reporter Jessica Strifles. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to head toward a break here. When we come back, here's the headline. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints unveils major changes to its Sunday worship services. We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Hope you stay with us through the break.
Hi, this is Nick Forrester. This week in E-Town, we're going to revisit one of our favorite shows. This one features the dynamic duo Shovels and Rope, young blues singer Nick Clark, plus a conversation with Jim Pugh, the founder of Little Village Records. That's all this week in E-Town.
Tune in Saturday evening at 7 here on UPR.
I'm Julie Rose, host of the Top of Mind podcast. Most countries have dark chapters, like slavery, genocide. Once enough time has passed, though, can we just close the book and move on?
You need to first have this baseline of what actually happened to develop sympathy, if not empathy, for people on different sides of societal divides.
Reckoning with past wrongs is Top of Mind.
Tune in Sunday morning at 9 here on UPR.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in for this segment to Salt Lake Tribune senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Peggy, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to do it.
So here's the news, the headline, The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints unveils major changes to its Sunday worship services. And we'll talk about this a little bit. This was just announced, right, this week. What's going to be happening?
Well, what they've changed is the schedule. In 2018, the church reduced its Sunday services from a block of 3 hours to 2 hours. And how they did it was a 1 hour for the major worship service, which is sacrament meeting, and 1 hour every other week, alternating weeks for Sunday school classes, which study scripture for 1 hour, and then alternate week, the All Women Relief Society or All Men priesthood meetings would meet for 1 hour again on the alternate Sunday. What they did this week is keeping the two blocks, keep the sacrament meeting 60 minutes, but instead of alternating weeks, the Sunday school classes will now be reduced to 25 minutes and the Relief Society and Young Women classes down to 25 minutes with 5 minutes transition in between these classes. It's a big change.
Yeah. I know there's a lot of discussion out there as well. We'll get to some quotes. You talk to some folks. What is the church saying about this? Why are they doing this?
They didn't
fully explain the reason, but apparently some people felt that meeting every week was more bonding, better to build rapport with one another, especially the young people. They're, very concerned about young people having a positive experience at church. And so to meet every single week, both all the young women together, all the young men together, and then also together, the whole group, they seem to think that will be a better way to, it's true of adults too. When I was writing about the church in Kenya, a woman said to me that she missed seeing her, quote, Relief Society sisters every week. So it's just an attempt to, I think, build the community better, to serve their needs, to help scripture study better.
It just
seems to be the motivation from the church.
Right. A little bit of change for teenagers, the youth.
Yes.
What will they be doing? That they'll be studying something different, I guess, than they had been in their classes.
Well, they haven't really had a curriculum for their classes, their young men, young women classes, since, for some years. They did away with the scouting program for young men and sort of general curriculum for young women. Now, apparently, they have a manual, which is based on what has been a pamphlet called For the Strength of Youth. It has monthly lessons and themes. I haven't checked that out, but I am going to. It should be interesting to see how that relates. So that's new as well.
Let's go over to your, there's a separate story where you talk to several people, getting their reaction to these changes. Here's the headline, reaction to meeting changes, big mistake, quote, I really like this idea, lightning round of gospel doctrine. Those are some of the reactions. What's top of mind for you? Maybe a couple of quotes that stood out to you.
Well, there's been a lot of buzz, honestly, about the shortness of the classes. 25 minutes, even though it's every week, is a pretty short amount of time to try to study scripture. Like the Old Testament is this year, Latter-day Saints are studying the Old Testament. People tend to be slow to get to class. And so that would end up being about 20 minutes. And so the main rub of that is that the guy who said big mistake, he said time is too short. Meetings will be conducted at the most superficial level possible. So, and I heard that quite a bit, is that the reduction of the time, one person who said the lightning round thing, she said, I really like the idea of having all three meetings again. I think especially for scripture discussions, having more continuity is important. So now scripture study will be every single week instead of every other week. But she says, at the same time, I can't even imagine trying to discuss the substance of several chapters of scripture in 20 minutes, as well as trying to incorporate questions and discussion with a class. It feels, she said, it feels like the lightning round of gospel doctrine. So that's... other people said, why couldn't they cut down the sacrament meeting to only 40 minutes and so have 40 sacrament meeting, 40 Sunday school, 40 Relief Society priesthood. They haven't done that. Patrick Mason, who's one of my go-to observers, teaches Mormon study, chair of Mormon history and culture at Utah State. He said he wished they would have added a half hour back in rather than dividing it this way. But he said he thinks it was motivated by the loss of community by not seeing each other on a weekly basis. And as I mentioned, that was felt most acutely in youth programs. And he raised an interesting question. He says, all of it will feel different, but is that so bad? Is the lesson more important than FaceTime? Meaning, essentially, is the lesson more important, fitting in all the points from scripture? Is that more important than just simply getting together? Maybe they'll simply talk to one another, and maybe that's not a bad thing.
Kind of following up on that, one person told you foyer and hallway church is important. They feel like maybe only 5 minutes to get from class to class, that might be harmed.
Yeah, and other people have said it might be challenging for older people who have a hard time moving quickly to go to two different places in that amount of time. There'll always be stragglers. And something that isn't in the story, but I've heard, is that it will be challenging in congregations or meeting houses where several congregations meet in the same place and they sort of stagger the time. And I think that could be a problem.
These changes won't take effect immediately, I think.
Nope. They start in September, in the fall.
Okay.
So give some members time to think about it, time to adapt to the idea, see how it might work.
So we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Peggy, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
You can find all the stories we've talked about today on sltrib.com. And thanks, everybody, for listening to Behind the Headlines today. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with me again next time.